You know, in a talk that he gave in the year 2005, the man who was about to become Pope Benedict XVI, although nobody knew that then, and he didn't expect that, lamented that, I quote, "We are building a dictatorship of relativism. A dictatorship of relativism," interesting expression, "that does not recognize anything as definitive, and whose ultimate goal consists solely of one's own ego and desires." Now, I think some people must have found this statement confusing. He said the dictatorship of relativism does not recognize anything as definitive, right? But a dictatorship makes everything definitive, doesn't it? It defines what you must do. It defines what you must believe. It defines what you must not do, and it defines what you must not believe. And yet he said that the dictatorship of relativism does not recognize anything as definitive. Well, then how can there be a dictatorship of relativism? Wouldn't relativism mean perfect freedom? 5 years later, by this time he was Pope Benedict, in an interview with a German journalist, Benedict explained, he said, that relativism seems to be freedom, quote, "for the sole reason that it is liberation from the previous situation." But in reality, he went on, "this development increasingly leads to an intolerant claim of a new religion, which pretends to be generally valid because it is reasonable, indeed because it's reason itself, which knows all and therefore defines the frame of reference that is now supposed to apply to everyone. In the name of tolerance," he said, "tolerance is being abolished." You can see how this works, can't you? Suppose we adopt a relativistic attitude toward the meaning of marriage. I apologize for my timidity in choosing such a non-controversial topic. Now, the old view is that marriage requires an exclusive commitment between a man and a woman. And so first we start asking questions. Who's to say whether marriage requires exclusivity? A little variety might be fun. Do you know there are some marriage counselors who tell couples that? Who is to say whether marriage requires commitment? We don't know how we'll feel next year. Who is to say whether marriage requires a man and a woman? Some men might prefer a harem of women. Notice that the question, who is to say, is a rhetorical question. To ask who is to say is a coded way of insisting that no one is to say and that there are no rational principles by which what is said could be said. That saying that there are no principles is in fact the only rational, the only reasonable position, which is why Benedict said that this religion presents itself as not being a religion, but is simply reasonableness itself. Well, next we ask, how dare you discriminate? Since no one is to say what marriage is, you aren't allowed to say that it requires a man and a woman. And finally, we discriminate. In the name of non-judgmentalism, we judge. We say, you aren't allowed to express the old view that marriage requires a man and a woman, but we are allowed to insist upon the new view that it doesn't. And this very soon becomes the official sexual creed in the law and in the public schools and in polite society. So what have we done here? What have we done? In the name of tolerating all views, what we've really done is authoritatively replaced one view with another. The view which used to define marriage is now defined as bigotry. And the view which used to define transgression against marriage is now defined as what all right-thinking persons should believe, with heretics to be suppressed. This is a very strange inversion. It's odd that an extremely harsh form of judgment could hide under the label of non-judgmentalism. It's odd, but on the other hand, it's very common. This strange inversion takes place in other spheres too. For example, asking who is to say which religion is true. We discriminate against the Christian faith because it is bigoted, to regard Christ as the embodiment of truth. Asking who is to say whether the unborn child is really a child, we discriminate against those who say that he is, because it's bigoted to want to protect him. You might think, I sort of have a point, but then I'm misstating it. You might think, okay, inconsistent relativists would behave that way, but consistent relativists wouldn't. These relativists are being inconsistent, because they say don't judge, but they're judging you and they're coming down hard on you. If they were consistent, they wouldn't do that. It might seem that although inconsistent relativists might abolish tolerance in the name of tolerance, consistent relativists wouldn't abolish anything. They really would be tolerant. But stop and think for a moment. That would be impossible, because there cannot be any consistent relativists. There couldn't be. If someone were relativistic about everything, then among other things, he would have to be relativistic about tolerance itself. He would have to ask, who is to say whether anything should be tolerated or what should be tolerated? Who is to say whether tolerance is right? You know, tolerance is considered a virtue, but a virtue is a moral concept. And he would say, like all other moral questions, this is relative too. It's all relative whether we tolerate one religion, six religions, or no religions and suppress them all. It's all relative whether, in the moral sphere, whether we tolerate rape or murder or popping chewing gum in the movie theater. You see, a consistent relativist couldn't exist. Because if he were consistent, he couldn't even be a relativist. He would have to say that relativism is all relative. That's why relativism has to be consistent. You will often find it said, you know, sometimes when I'm speaking with philosophers, my home-based department is actually a government department, but what I do is political and ethical philosophy, and sometimes when I'm speaking with philosophers, they say, why do you talk about relativism? You know, nobody's a serious relativist anymore, and what they mean by that is that it's not a position that can be maintained consistently. And that's true, but on the other hand, as a cultural force, it's enormously strong. And although under the name relativism, it doesn't these days, it did 35 years ago, it doesn't infect philosophers. Under other names, moral anti-realism, and, you know, other kind of neutralism and things like that, deontological neutralism, under other names it does infect them. Anyway, relativism has to be inconsistent, and that is why it never is what it seems to be. So-called relativism, or neutrality, or non-judgmentalism, or moral anti-realism, or whatever you want to call it, is always a disguise for imposing someone's moral judgment upon others without having to give reasons for it. And Benedict was right. This is dictatorship. Now, you should ask me, what do you mean, dictatorship? Is it a dictatorship because it defends a particular moral judgment? No. It's not dictatorial to defend a particular moral judgment. It's a dictatorship because it pretends it isn't doing so. Is it dictatorship because it seeks to be expressed in the law? No. Can you imagine how horrible it would be? I mean, if the law did not recognize the wrong of murder? It would be absurd to say how intolerant you are of murder. Who is to say whether his murder is wrong? No, our moral judgments have to take expression. I don't say that everything that is morally wrong should also be illegal, but the law is inevitably going to reflect a certain moral point of view, and we have to hope that it's a correct one. Is it dictatorship then because it seeks to be expressed in the law? No, it's dictatorship because in the final analysis, what it calls law is not an ordinance of reason, but an arbitrary use of force. The kind of moralism, if you want to call it that, that I would defend, says, here's what I think is right and good, and here is why. And it engages respectfully with the other person. This kind of moralism, since it says, who is to judge? Essentially, it is the simple use of force. Now, don't get me wrong. It may seem as though I'm speaking against tolerance, against toleration, and I'm not. There is such a thing as true tolerance, authentic tolerance, but it has nothing to do with relativism, nothing to do with asking who is to say, nothing to do with asking who is to judge. In fact, the real reason for tolerating some views that we consider wrong or mistaken is that the view that we judge objectively true requires us to do so. This is actually the older understanding of toleration. You will often hear a false history, which says that toleration was invented in the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was not a particularly tolerant time. And that says that it's all about moral neutrality or non-judgmentalism. No. That's an incoherent, impossible defense of toleration. If you were going to say that, you couldn't say what is to be tolerated. But the older view is that we know what to tolerate, even though we think it is wrong, because of what we think is true. That the view that we consider true requires the toleration of certain kinds of error and wrong. Does that sound paradoxical? Then I'll give you an example. St. Hilary of Poitiers. He certainly didn't think that judgment was wrong. He certainly didn't even think that all coercion is wrong or that law is wrong. But he did think that it was wrong to coerce people to worship. Why? He thought we should tolerate people who don't worship. Why? Did he take that view because who's to say whether there's a God? No. Did he take that view because who is to say whether God has any authority anyway? No. Did he take that view because who is to say whether God requires worship? No. In fact, he asserted that there is a God, that God does have authority, and that God does require worship. But he said, and I quote, "God does not require unwilling worship." In other words, God is of such a nature that he abhors the coercion of conscience, which after all is something that he made. And this is something that we can know about him. It's because Hilary believes he does know something about God, that he knows that there are certain things that have to be tolerated. True tolerance, then, isn't relativistic. It is not based on suspending judgment. It is based on judging better, on judging well. In this case, judging well about the nature of that kind of faith, which is pleasing to the true God. Now we encounter a difficulty. If, in order to practice true toleration, we have to know something about God, and something about right, and something about wrong, and something about good, and something about evil, then what can we know about these things? And that's where the title of my talk comes in, after all. What do we really know about right and wrong? My answer to the question, what can we know about these things, is quite a bit. There's an awful lot that we can know, and it isn't difficult to know them, although some of the details are hard to figure out. Any ethicist who pretends that there are no hard cases is very naive. I don't know any who are that naive. There are hard cases, but you know, those are the details. The general principles are not at all difficult to figure out. I'm not thinking of the moral views of one particular culture or group or religion. For example, although I am Catholic, and I'm speaking in a Catholic forum, after all, dedicated to the promulgation of the views of Thomas Aquinas, I'm not speaking about quote-unquote Catholic morality. I'm speaking about morality for everyone. Now, granted, it's not accepted by everyone, and it isn't followed by everyone, but, you know, its basic principles have been known for thousands of years and substantially acknowledged by almost all human cultures. The very best summary of it that we possess is the Decalogue or Ten Commandments. Now, at this point, maybe some of you are thinking, oh, you really let us down here. So when you said that you weren't speaking just of Catholic morality, you lied. You deceiving professor. You wayward malcontent, you globe of lying continence. Did you like the little Shakespearean bit there? Substantially acknowledged by all cultures, did you say? Didn't you think that we would notice that the Ten Commandments are from your own Bible? Well, sure, they're in the Bible. But you know the things that are expressed in the Ten Commandments in the Bible are in a lot of other places, too. The biblical Decalogue is merely a more perfect expression of what the classical tradition calls the natural law, which is dimly known everywhere. St. Paul described it as written on the heart. People sometimes get mixed up about what the heart is. That doesn't mean your feelings, although it has something to do with your feelings. It means the core of your being, the core of your will, the core of your intellect. There are certain things that deep down we can't not know. People in every place and time recognize that it's good to honor parents. It isn't as though people started to believe that only after Moses came down from the mountain with some stone tablets. People in every place and time recognize that it's wrong to commit murder, to deliberately take innocent human life, and so on. In fact, I wouldn't say that these are things we don't really know, or things that we can't really know, or say, who is to judge? I would say that they're things that we can't not know. It is impossible not to know them. We do know them. The human moral intellect is designed to know them, even though we may fudge the details, even though we may not live up to these principles. We know the basics. They constitute the deep structure of conscience. They aren't things that are proven. They are things by which everything else is proven. Now, when I say, I want to be understood here, because when I say that the Decalogue is a good summary of the natural law, I mean something very specific. When I first began studying these things and came across the claim in the natural law tradition that the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, are a good summary of the natural law, I thought, well, that's a little thin, isn't it? So you can't murder, but you can break somebody's arm, or you can't commit adultery, but you can commit what, incest or premarital sex or something. It's a little thin, but no. The sense in which the Decalogue is a summary is that the Ten Commandments are ten metonyms. I don't know if you know this expression. Metonymy is a figure of speech. It's not one of the more common figures of speech in English. We're more familiar with metaphor and analogy and simile and certain other figures of speech. But metonymy is very, very common, and we do sometimes use it in English. It's the figure of speech where we use a part to represent a whole. I may say the crown, but I mean the entire institution of the monarchy. Okay? And traditionally, both in rabbinical interpretation and in Christian interpretation, the Ten Commandments were taken this way. So the prohibition of murder is not just about murder. What's happening is that the gravest wrong against another person's body is used here to stand for all wrongs against another person's body. In the same way, the prohibition of adultery is not just about adultery. The gravest offense against marriage and against sexual impurity is used here as a placeholder for all wrongs against marriage and against the purposes of sexuality. So actually, what we have here in the Ten Commandments isn't thin at all. There's a lot. A lot comes packed into this. Now, in a certain sense, these commandments are non-controversial. So non-controversial that somebody might yawn when I say, well, the morality that we all really know is the Ten Commandments, but in another way, they're quite controversial. For example, not many people would say, I'm for murder. Well, I think murder is okay. You'd have to search far and wide before you found somebody who said that. But a great many people would like to say, would like to fudge the details. They'd like to say, well, abortion isn't murder. I say, work it out. Work it out. What do we mean? I mean, we've been talking about these things for centuries. And we understand murder to be the deliberate taking of an innocent human life. Well, is abortion deliberate? Yes. Does it take a life? Yes. Is the life human? Well, it's not a dog or a porpoise in there. And is the life innocent? Of course it is. The baby didn't force his way in. Although I have to tell you, I have read a book by a feminist attorney who argues that, she says, yes, abortion is the deliberate taking of a human life. But she says, that doesn't make it wrong because that human being in the womb is not innocent. And this is capital punishment, you see. She says, he's guilty of making the woman pregnant against her will. And so he deserves death as a penalty. I mean, you see then, in one sense, the wrong murder is non-controversial. In another way, because we play tricks on ourselves, it's very controversial. Or consider another example. Not many people would defend adultery in the narrow sense, sleeping with somebody else's wife or husband. Although, you know, I have noticed a shift in the culture that is becoming more acceptable now. On the other hand, the precept has always been understood as forbidding every sort of extramarital sex. Now, every age has its favorite sin. There are ages in which lying is the favorite sin, ages in which sins against another person's property are the favorite sin, or physical violence is the favorite sin. In ours, the favorite sin seems to be sex outside the bonds of marriage. We claim that the prohibition of casual sex is just an irrational taboo, handed down from an irrational time long ago. I, once in a course on natural law, I presented what the classical argument is as to what are the rational foundations of sexual morality. One of my students came up to me afterward. He thanked me. I mean, I often get a lot of pushback, as you would imagine. But this particular student thanked me. He said, you know, I've been told all my life that this and everything in morality is just taboos, that they're just cultural constructs. And he wasn't sure what he thought, but he thought it was a great weight off of him to know that there could be a rational defense there somewhere. But let's think again about this idea that it is an irrational taboo. The most common reason for thinking that the prohibition is just an irrational taboo and that casual sex is okay is expressed in the saying, it doesn't hurt anyone. Now that's only one of a large number of reasons that people give, but just for illustration, I'll focus on that one. It doesn't hurt anyone. You know, in the first place, the idea that something is okay if it doesn't hurt anyone is not a very thick concept of right or wrong, is it? Suppose somebody was never kind or considerate to his wife, but he boasted that he never beat her. He said, well, you know, I haven't hurt anyone. Suppose a teacher had never taught his students a single truth, but he boasted that he'd never told them any lies. I haven't hurt anyone. There's something missing from such an ethic. But that's not all. In order to believe that premarital sex doesn't hurt anyone, you have to be pulling a very large piece of wool over a very squinty set of eyes. Consider just a few of the fruits of the sexual revolution. How about loneliness and lack of true intimacy? Because, you know, sex is like adhesive tape. If you keep sticking it on, it has a tendency to bond. If you keep sticking it on and pulling it off, sticking it on and pulling it off, eventually it can no longer bond. The tape loses its stickiness. And that's a dreadful thing. The second is emptiness, because such a powerful force as sex has to mean something, and we treat it as though it means nothing. And then comes fatherlessness, because single women get pregnant with no one to help them raise the children. That's awfully hard. Next, atheism, because boys raised without fathers find it difficult to trust God the Father. I used to wonder why it is that 25 years ago, 30 years ago when I began to teach, there were very few atheists among my students, very few agnostics. I understand that some people give rational arguments for atheism, but most of the people whom I meet today who tell me that they are atheists and who are now a large proportion of my students, especially young men, seem not to have arrived at it by very careful logical reasoning, but usually it's a kind of an angry atheism. And as I talked to them, I began to find that in most cases there was a very defective relationship with the father, or maybe he just wasn't there at all. The psychologist Paul Vince has talked a lot about that. Now, so I'm not going to dismiss those who have intellectual difficulties believing in God by saying it's all just something irrational like that. But we should be aware that that is quite common. Well, that's a footnote. I'm getting off my track. I was saying next comes atheism because boys raised without fathers find it difficult to trust God as father. Next comes poverty, because women now so often have to provide for their children by themselves without assistance. You know, the advent of no-fault divorce has done amazing things. After a no-fault divorce, the guy is usually better off in terms of income. The woman is usually significantly worse off. Well, next comes adolescent difficulty and disorientation and criminality, because children who are missing their fathers and mothers have a harder time growing up. A generation and a half ago, family sociologists did some very rather poor, actually, early limited studies with bad controls and bad statistical techniques, and said, gee, it looks like divorce and things like that don't hurt kids at all. A kid doesn't need a mom and a dad. A kid can do just as well with one parent. I don't want to diss people who do this sometimes heroic effort of trying to raise a child when they have nobody to help them. But, you know, it just isn't true that it makes no difference. Many of those same sociologists, now 35 years later, have changed their minds and said, we were wrong. We've got larger data sets, better statistical techniques, and so forth. And in fact, the consequences for children are rather dreadful. And many of you know that from experience. Of course, there's venereal disease, because formerly rare infections spread rapidly through sexual contact. When I was a kid in high school, and they warned us about these things, you know, there were only two or three that doctors would talk about, and now it's more like 20 or 30. There's, of course, child abuse, because live-in boyfriends tend to resent their girlfriends' babies, and live-in girlfriends tend to sacrifice their children to their boyfriend's approval. Of course, there's divorce, because wantonness leads to betrayal. And finally, abortion, because children are increasingly regarded as a burden rather than a joy. All that, and that's not even everything. All that, and we still excuse the way we live by saying, well, it doesn't hurt anyone. It doesn't hurt anyone. Of course, all of these problems existed before. But they're much worse now. And I beg you, don't tell me that they're all going to be solved if only people contracept. Let's not play that game. Isn't it curious that the problems that I've mentioned have all become so much more widespread after the invention and widespread use of the pill? Did you know that? It's true. It's true. The pill was supposed to end out-of-wedlock pregnancy. That was what people thought. What's happened is that when chemical contraception was invented and considered acceptable, rates of out-of-wedlock pregnancy soared, skyrocketed, went right through the roof. Does that suggest something to you? Contraception isn't the solution. It's part of the problem. It hasn't changed the structure of sexual morality as we sometimes think. We say, oh, you know, old-fashioned people said that by the natural law you have to be careful about sex because it can lead to children, but it doesn't lead to children anymore. That was only a time-bound, temporary sort of truth. Well, no. The structure of sexuality hasn't been changed. We've merely been provided with new excuses for thinking that we don't have to follow it. We are living an illusion. In the words of T.S. Eliot, the poet, we are dreaming of systems so perfect that no one has to be good. When I was a young man, I was a socialist. I remember going to a talk by a famous socialist at the time, Michael Harrington. And somebody in the audience asked him afterward, he says, well, all this sounds very nice, Mr. Harrington, but what about selfishness? Socialism seems to presuppose that nobody's going to be selfish and everybody will share. And he said, no. He said, you don't understand. He said, once there's socialism, there won't be any scarcity anymore. And once there's no scarcity, nobody will be selfish anymore. It's all just because of the way we live, you see, and we can invent our ways out of this, okay? a technical adjustment in the means of production and distribution is going to eliminate a moral problem? No, that's just another example of what T.S. Eliot said. We dream of systems so perfect that nobody has to be good. Sometimes we dream of engineering, social engineering, changes in the economy, something chemical or medical like the pill. We dream of systems so perfect that nobody has to be good. Now, I'd like you to notice something. I don't know, some of you may be outraged by what I'm saying, but you know, not once in the brief argument for traditional sexual morality, that was my second example, you remember, that I just presented, have I said, the Bible says. Not once. Not once have I said, the Catechism says, or Pope John Paul II said, or even Thomas Aquinas said, even though this is the Thomistic Institute. In fact, I've deliberately restricted myself, as I told you ahead of time that I would, to the criterion of morality the secular persons tend to use. The criterion that says that it's okay if it doesn't hurt anyone. That thin and inadequate catchphrase that it's all that whatever doesn't hurt anyone is okay. All I've done is pointed out grave and growing ways in which we do hurt each other, but that we tend to ignore. Oh, it can be complicated. My generation invented the sexual revolution, but escaped some of its consequences. The current generation is feeling, it's paying the price for the dinner that my generation ordered. So there are complications. It isn't always the same person who feels the consequence, but somebody does, and they add up. And this is true about other things too. It's true about lying. It's true about theft. It's true about dishonoring parents. Now, since I'm speaking about morality for everyone, that's what I've claimed, not just for Catholics, there's no reason why people like me shouldn't be able to offer such arguments to anyone, irrespective of their religious convictions or lack thereof. In fact, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to offer them, well, yes, right here in the public square. Some people tell people like me, usually there's at least an imaginary shaking of the finger, promoting so-called sexual purity reflects an irrational animus. A few of you here are from the law school, and you know that that's an expression that has been used by the Supreme Court. Or, that's just slut-shaming, or stop cramming your Catholic morality down my throat, or perhaps your Christian morality. They've got it backwards. They're expressing an irrational animus against human morality, in my opinion. And they are the ones cramming it down others' throats, because they are the ones trying to shame those who disagree with them. Now, of course, anything that somebody else says might have a tendency to make me feel ashamed. It doesn't follow from the fact that I feel ashamed by something that he said, that he was trying to shame me. And of course, something that I could say might make somebody feel ashamed, but I'm not, but I haven't said anything like shame on you. I haven't blamed people personally, I'm just commenting on objective morality. I'm defending human morality. It might also be called humane morality, because it promotes human flourishing, even if you disagree with me. I'm trying to make headway by nothing but not by rational persuasion. But that raises a question. I claim that this moral law is dimly known everywhere. If it is, then why don't we live up to it? My students sometimes ask me, Professor, if there's a natural law, then it would be impossible to do wrong. That's thinking of the natural law like the laws of gravity. No, the natural law are the conditions for flourishing for creatures of our nature. Okay? And viewed as laws, they are directed to an intelligent being that has to agree to align his will with them. It is possible to disagree with them. But why do we? The problem is this. You know, the moral law is universal. But the desire to escape from it is universal too. There are two universals we're dealing with, not just one. There's a lot of confusion about this point. People think, for instance, that if the moral law is dimly known everywhere, then we ought to always feel guilty whenever we violate it, and that doesn't always happen. Is there anyone in this room who has never had the experience of doing something that you knew to be wrong, but you didn't feel bad about it? That has happened to me, I'm ashamed to say. I think it's happened to everybody. You can know something is wrong and not feel bad. That's not the question, whether you always feel bad. It's what you know deep down. The solution is then that people confuse guilty knowledge with guilty feelings. Actually, guilty conscience, which is guilty knowledge, tracks us down, even if we don't have guilty feelings. It's a curious thing, but it's true. It's very powerful. What are some of the ways in which it does that? Well, one is that we try to avoid thinking about what we've done. We may succeed to the point that we don't have bad feelings, but you know, there are psychological consequences here. It takes an awful lot of energy. It can be exhausting. You have to work every day at not thinking about certain things. Another is that sometimes a person may compulsively confess everything about what he has done, except for the fact that it was wrong. It's a little bit outdated now, but I used to call that the Jerry Springer show syndrome. People would go on this television show and talk about all kinds of weird things that they had done, and they were almost boasting, but they would confess everything, every sort of detail, but not that it was wrong. Well, you know, the compulsion to confess suggests a troubled conscience. A third is that in the hope of atoning somehow for what we've done, we make ourselves suffer. We make ourselves suffer, submitting to 100 different pains and paying 100 different prices. Well, for some people, this might mean getting yourself wrecked with drugs or alcohol, or it might mean breaking up friendships that had meant a lot to you. My wife was for 13 years a crisis pregnancy counselor. She said nothing was more common than this. A young woman might have an abortion because she was afraid that her boyfriend would break up with her. Then she had the abortion and she broke up with her boyfriend. And sometimes they come to recognize why they did it and say, I was punishing myself. All because we refuse to pay the one price demanded, which is repenting our wrong and turning to the mercy of God. Yet another is that since we're not in sync with justice, we endlessly justify ourselves. We simulate getting in sync with justice, you see? We make excuses. We plunge into denial. We pretend that we didn't know all sorts of things that we really do know. Consider cannibals. Not too many around here, I hope. Their problem isn't that they're ignorant of the wrong of deliberately taking innocent life, human life. Actually, they do know that. They don't kill their fellow humans in their own tribes. What they pretend not to know is that the fellows in the other tribe are human. They pretend not to know that they are human. And even at that, they betray guilty knowledge that they really are human. They know better than what they tell themselves. Why else would they engage in elaborate rituals to expiate sin before going on a raid? That level of self-deception might seem ludicrous. How could you say, oh, yeah, of course it's wrong to take innocent human life, but they're not human? Well, let's not preen ourselves on our superiority to the cannibals. It might be easy to preen ourselves on our superiority to the Nazis, who often pretended that the Jews were not human. But we don't have to do that either. The pretense that the fellows in the other tribe are not human, or that the Jews are not human, it's no more ludicrous than our pretense that, for example, the baby in the womb is not human. For that matter, it's no more ludicrous than most of our pretenses. For example, that living together without vows is good practice for living with vows. Or that vows are not really vows and may be broken. Or that people who deliberately hold back from entering a commitment may still have a committed relationship. I dare to say that concerning the basic principles of morality, the basics, mind you, not the details, no one is truly ignorant. But there is a great deal of denial, a great burden of self-deception, a great number of lies that we cunningly tell ourselves. I'm speaking from experience there, by the way, as well as theoretically. The difficulty is that the problem of right and wrong is not just a problem of knowledge, but a problem of will. It isn't just cognitive, it's volitional. Yes, a law is written on the heart of man, but it is everywhere entangled with the evasions and subterfuges of men. That's why I suggest here in this Catholic forum, where I might be expected to say something different, that the originality of Catholic teaching about morality is not what it says about right and wrong. That's not chiefly what makes it original. Not at all, because the moral basics belong to the patrimony of the entire human race. I think the Church teaches these much more clearly, but, you know, you're not going to find a tribe that doesn't know that they should honor their parents. The originality of Catholic teaching about morality lies elsewhere, because it isn't enough to know the truth deep down. That's the expression that I've used. It isn't enough to recognize it dimly. I may know it, but prefer not to know it. I may know it, but tell myself that I don't know it. I may know it, but live as though I don't know it. And to live in that way is to deny the very truth of my being. It's to be unfree. You know, we think of morality as a set of rules that make us unfree. The contrary is actually true. To be truly free, to be true to myself, to be true to the image of God, which is myself, I must want true freedom. And I must want it more than I want this vanity of vanities, this emptiness of emptinesses that I call my freedom. And this can happen in only one way. I'm not going to want truth that way unless I am converted into truth. I must be converted into truth. All my dross, all my scum and stain must be burned away so that nothing true is left in me, which, by the way, is not something I can do by myself. How much do I want that anyway? How much do I want that? It's too little to want it a little. I must want it completely. Only the pure in heart shall see God. Do I dare to desire that, which so far transcends my imagination of what is sweet and lovely that I tremble to conceive it? Do I want to be loved by that which loves me more than I love myself? After my last ruse has failed, after my last refuge has been penetrated, my last pretense has been dispersed, and I'm finally cornered, will I at last yield myself to truth? To be scoured and polished and made honest until I can give back his light? If I can't yield, am I at least willing to want that I should yield? If I'm not willing to want it, am I at least willing to want to be willing that I should want it? And at least, will I yield to being helped? You know, I've been saying, I. Will I yield? Will I yield? Well, I guess it's bad manners to talk to myself. It's rude to ignore my listeners. Will you? Thank you. I see my host is standing up. Did you want to say something?
Oh, just that. I know you wanted to have a Q&A session.
Yes.
So please, you want to do a question.
Yes, sir.
If the end is to yield.
What is to yield?
If the end is to yield, and is the primary means to do that through logical reason?
No. No, I think that what I'm talking about yielding to, obviously, is God.
And I think we need his grace to do that. I think that we are some... What I'm about to say may sound bleak. I'm really very hopeful rather than bleak. But I think that in order to entertain true hope, one has to know how serious the situation is that you can be hopeful about. Our condition is kind of like that of a surgeon who is very good. He's in sewing on severed limbs and things like that, and his own hands have been cut off. He cut them off. You know, you can cut off your own hands, but you can't sew them back on. Somebody else is going to have to do it. And what we have to do is yield to God. I think that, you know, that's grace. It is something you can't reason your way into, even though curiously it's reasonable. It's funny, it's reasonable in one way, but it's not reason, but it's beyond reason in another. If you were when I was before my wife and I were married and we were in courtship, I could learn more and more about her. And I could think she really seems to be a wonderful person and so forth. But you know, there comes a point where you just have to trust. Where marriage is a sort of a leap. Where you're not, there are additional things that you cannot learn until you're on the inside. You have to learn them from the inside. And I think it's like that with the relationship with God too. And so that it's not that it's unreasonable to trust, but the act of trust is something more than that. Or to take another example, if I'm in a burning building and I'm on the third floor, and I'm afraid if I jump, I'm going to break my neck. Maybe let's make it the sixth floor. Maybe you could not break your neck with three floors. I don't know how many floors it would take. And all the smoke is obscuring the ground, and I hear a voice, and it says, "You up there in room 821, jump." I say, "I'm afraid, I can't see you." And they say, "But we can see you. And we're holding a net. Jump." Now, is it reasonable for me to jump? Yes, but it still requires something more than just reason. I have to trust. I have to trust. And it is like that with God, I think. Yes, sir.
So I guess with like the idea of the morality being natural law, I mean, that, so what about the kind of arguments about the, like that it's the kind of morality, maybe natural law, but it's kind of like a biological,
okay,
you know, something that just sort of is an evolutionary process.
Yeah, is it just biological? There is an area in evolutionary biology today that is sometimes called evolutionary psychology or evolutionary ethics. I've been at conferences with these guys, and that is, in fact, what they would say. It's all evolutionary. Although, you know, there's a sort of a problem there. For one thing, look, if you say that's all it is, then it isn't really morality, right? It's only a set of impulses that I've been left with by a long evolutionary process that was meaningless and purposeless and did not have me in mind. So that, yeah, I've come out with genes so that I want to take care of my kids, but if I'd been a guppy instead of a human being, I might have wanted to eat my kids. That's what guppies will do, and that would have been okay too. And it makes morality arbitrary, which means it isn't really morality. There are other problems too. You know, if it's just an instinct, if it's just something built in, I shouldn't be able to resist it. But I can resist it. I'd also always think that what I felt was true, but I may have some instinct, some impulse, and say to myself, "But that's wrong." So, you know, apparently what's going on instinctually or impulsively or in our feelings is not the same as the moral law itself. There was a guy, let me see if I can remember his name. His book was called "But What If She Wants to Die?" He was a convicted murderer. He'd murdered his wife. She had MS, and he claimed that she wanted to die, although the jury ultimately believed that he was lying about that. He stuffed her full of pills and put a plastic bag over her head. Well, he goes to prison. After he gets out of prison, he writes this book. What if she wanted to die? What if she wants to die? And at a certain point in the book, he says that for months after the murder, he felt terrible pangs of remorse. But finally, he came to terms with this because he reminded himself that these were merely expressions of the primate inhibition against killing your own kind. And so they were meaningless and not real morality. Now, I wonder what he thought real morality was, because he had no basis for saying what it might be. So I do think it has something to do with how we are made. The God who designed in us certain conditions for flourishing arranged our bodies in accordance with this. But there's more to it than that. There's no gene for recognizing the golden rule. There's no gene for charity.
I guess, kind of, what about those the psychopathic?
That's a good question too, and it's a separate question. So-called sociopaths or psychopaths, some psychologists distinguish between those two kinds of people, and some people don't. Some of them don't. These are the famous people without a conscience. And you know, even in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the handbook for psychotherapists and so forth, it describes them sometimes as, I've looked at several versions of it, DSM-4 and DSM-5. So they're sometimes described as having no conscience. But if you look more carefully at the descriptions, they're not saying they don't have any moral knowledge. They're saying they don't have normal moral feelings. And I'm not saying at all, as a matter of fact, I emphasized, that it's quite possible not to have normal moral feelings. All of us have had the experience, well, unless there are some of you who are keeping it a secret when I ask, which would be all right. It wasn't really meant for answering out loud. I think each of us has had the experience of doing something you knew was wrong, but you didn't feel bad. Psychopaths and sociopaths are just people who are like that all the time. They never feel bad about it, but that's different than not knowing. You know, there are curious things. They sometimes make excuses. They express a dissatisfaction with their own condition and say they don't feel connection with people sometimes. Why should they think that they should feel connection if they have no conscience? Why should they be able to recognize that as a defect in themselves? One guy in my own town in Austin, this was in the newspaper years ago, he had gone into a video rental store. Back in those days, people rented videotapes. Okay, this was a long time ago. It was only a little bit after they gave up dial phones. And he blew away the clerk. I mean, he killed him. And he was apprehended. He was put in jail. The police had said that he seemed to have no conscience. And a reporter had gone down and talked to him and said, yeah, he doesn't seem to have conscience. And there had been some... Well, another reporter went down there to talk to him. I guess he was puzzled by this story. And he said, don't you feel bad about what you did? And the guy said, no. I don't know, that perhaps the reporter was just dumbfounded, didn't know what to say next. So there may have been a long silence, and the guy spoke into that silence. He said, no, I don't feel bad for what I did. But there must be something wrong with me, don't you think? Because I should feel bad for what I did. If you feel bad for not feeling bad, then you obviously don't have the appropriate feelings, but you do have some knowledge. And it's the knowledge that is conscience. You know, I'll concede that if you don't have normal feelings, it is going to be more difficult for you to learn some of the extras about right and wrong than for other people, because our minds and our feelings cooperate. Feelings sometimes provide data. But it's not that he knows nothing. Okay? Who else? Yes, ma'am.
What do you say to somebody who believes that morality comes from nurture?
Well, let's think about that. It is certainly true that that parents teach us a lot of stuff. But how do they teach it? There has to be something there that they in us already that they can grab hold of, or they can't do it. When I was young, I was taught in school... And I read Freud, and I read the social psychologists, and they seem to argue that morality is something pumped in from outside by socialization, by your parents, or by your teachers, or by your ministers, or by the policemen, or something like that. But if there's not already the right stuff inside you, that you can't be pumped in. You know, it's just like in arithmetic. You can teach a child, he didn't know 2 plus 2 is 4. And you can teach him that 2 plus 2 is 4. But you can't teach it to him unless he can recognize the truth of it for himself. You can say, look, son, or look, daughter, you know, how many is this? He's learned to count. 1, 2. How many is this? 1, 2. Now how many? 1, 2, 3, 4. So 2 with 2 is 4. He gets it. He sees it for himself. And then you're pointing out to him something that he could have seen for himself but didn't. And reinforcing it and drilling it and all that. In the same way, here Timmy has been pulling Susie's hair. And Mom says, don't pull Susie's hair. How would you like it if she pulled your hair? Well, before a certain age, the kid might not feel bad about that. But at a certain point, the child is able to see for himself that that is right. And he feels ashamed. He feels wrong. You know, I guess I don't want to do that. Well, so he may not never have heard, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And in fact, his mother has not actually explicitly formulated that principle. But she's relying on the fact that it will make sense to his mind. And that's because we have a moral intellect. That is because of how we are naturally made.
Follow up on that question.
Yes.
What's wrong with her just commanding her child to say, don't pull your child's hair, and not provide an explanation? And the child just submits.
Well, there is a place for sheer command without a reason. Children at a certain age especially will argue and argue and argue. And it becomes a sort of a game, and you get lost in the arguments, and you know, you're losing your authority. Sometimes, actually, it is rational. It is even in the interests of being able to, of them being able to engage in moral reasoning later on, for you not to give a reason. That's certainly true. But there comes a point at which children are ready for reasons, and at which they need to have reasons. You know, don't do that. Well, why? It's fine.
Yeah.
You know, because it's wrong. Why is it wrong? Well, you wouldn't want somebody to do that. Oh.
I mean, what seems more important to me is the rational command, not that there's a reason for the command.
Yeah, well, there's going to have to be a reason sometime. How much reasoning you're engaging in at different ages, it varies. Aristotle used to say, now he was teaching grown-ups. He was probably teaching young men who were in their 30s, I would guess, because they considered you still youth until you were about 35. But he even commented in the Nicomachean Ethics, his most famous book on ethics, that you can't get anywhere teaching ethics to somebody who hasn't been well brought up, because you can engage in these arguments, and this isn't the expression that Aristotle used, but it's what he meant. He just doesn't get it. The arguments are only cleverness. You know, they're just a game. So you can prematurely give reasons. You can get distracted into intellectual games with giving reasons. But a rational command has to actually appeal to the mind, or it's not going to take root. If the kid thinks the only reason to do this or not to do this is because sheer parental force is behind it, then when mom and dad aren't looking, he won't do it. I mean, you know, he won't follow the command. He won't do it. He won't do as they said. He says, "I'm just going to do as I please now. I've escaped from underneath that weight and that thumb." Yes, sir.
How do you define natural law? And how does it relate to conscience?
Okay, let's think of it this way. Natural law, two words, one's an adjective, natural, one's a noun, law. What does it mean to call it law? Law, and this is all law, divine law, human law, natural law. Law is an ordinance of reason for the common good, made by competent public authority, and made known. You can see that with the traffic law, right? My mind can see that it's right. Why is it right? It's because it's for the common good,
I can't make the traffic law. It was made by an appropriate authority, and it was made known. If a policeman pulled me over and said, "You're speeding," and I said, "No, I'm not speeding. That's not what the speed limit sign said," and he said, "It's a secret speed limit." Well, that wouldn't really be a law. Now, it's the same thing with the moral law, the natural law. Don't murder, right? It is an ordinance. My mind can see that this is right. It is for the common good. It is made by the public authority of the whole universe, because he's built this into my nature by making a good and giving me a moral intellect. And it has been made known. Because we all really do know it, not just because mommies and daddies told us and because the legislators told us, but because of conscience. Now, let's go back to that adjective, natural. Why do we call it natural? It's natural in, I'd say, at least four ways. One is that it corresponds to the deep structure of conscience. Okay? This is a feature of human nature. And that partly answers your question about conscience. I'm not talking about the superficial levels of conscience. I'm not talking about the stuff that is pumped in, but I'm talking about the deep structure that has to be there or nothing can be pumped in. Number two, it is natural in the sense that it responds to the recognition that we are meaningful wholes, that we are designed. Okay? When we recognize that we're designed, we recognize that there must be a designer. This elicits gratitude. Now, that in itself is an impulse of conscience. Gratitude. We know that we should feel grateful. We should be grateful, excuse me, when somebody has been our benefactor. But because of the design, it now ratifies conscience, because I say, oh, my conscience, which I talked about that first consideration, was not just one of the features of this meaningless and purposeless stuff that did not have me in mind. I'm meant to have this. Okay? So there's conscience, there's the recognition of designedness in general. Number three, recognition of the details of the design. Men and women are incomplete without each other. Human beings in general are incomplete without each other. We need to know the truth. We are made to know the truth. Freud talked about repression as being so terrible. It's funny, he talked about repression of sex, but repression of the longing to know the truth is much more terrible and has much more terrible consequences. There are all kinds of, you know, features of our nature. And then finally, there's number four, is it's natural in the sense that there are natural consequences. If I cut myself, I bleed. That's a physical consequence. If I betray all my friends, I'm going to have no friends. That's a social consequence. If I lie to myself, well, I'm going to have to tell another lie to cover up that lie to myself. And pretty soon, I'm going to get confused about what's a lie and what's the truth and be completely messed up. And that's a noetic consequence that has to do with the structure of knowledge. There are all, you know, consequences just at every level. And those are natural consequences. They're not inflicted by a human authority. So we've got natural deep conscience, we've got natural recognition of design, natural recognition of the details, natural recognition of the natural consequences. Those are the reasons we call this law natural, and those are the means by which we know it. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. So, for example, with individuals who are psychopathic or sociopathic, or something that is really popular now, the transgender movement, who they're mentally incapacitated and they legitimately believe that they are whatever gender opposite of them,
yes,
they actually are. So I guess my question is, with people like that who are actually handicapped, upon whom does the duty fall upon to enlighten them to try to help them out? Is there a duty, or what is the option for individuals like that?
Well, I would say that the question regarding the duty to try to help people like that come to a better understanding of themselves is no different than the duty to help anyone who is who is involved in a deep error, okay? You may have a friend who is in a bad relationship. You may know somebody who's considering an abortion. You may have to. Whose duty is it? It's most nearly the duty of those who are most nearly connected with that person. Strangers may not be able to reach them. On the other hand, strangers can do other things. Strangers can make laws. Strangers can build hospitals. Strangers can write books. Strangers can try to do research and understand how such confusions arise. Strangers can do journalism to discover the vast network of deceptions that's been involved in claiming that this isn't harming people. So it's not as though there's one person who uniquely is in the situation. This is the deconfuser. And even with people we know closely, as I'm sure you've found in your own experience, there are times when people will talk about their difficulties, and there are times when people won't. And the times when they will may be very rare. And that may sometimes be partly our fault. We may be arrogant or something. And you have to wait, and you have to wait, and you have to pray, and you have to wait for the opportunities and then grab them. Because if somebody is suffering, there will be a moment when the defenses fall and the gate opens and people can hear you.
So you, as you mentioned, St. Paul said that the law, the natural law, is written on our hearts. And that
yes.
doesn't mean, you know, sort of our feelings, but some part of our being.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it's sort of intrinsically human, maybe sort of stemming from the fact that we have God-given souls, or is it
yes.
maybe some sort of basic fact about the universe that we're
yes, this is it reflects something about the universe, okay? The universe is not just stuff. But things do have purposes. My heart is for the purpose of pumping blood. Teleology, quote-unquote, actually makes sense. My heart is for the purpose of pumping blood. My eyes are for the purpose of seeing. My capacity for anger is for the purpose of arousing me to the ordinate defense of endangered goods. My sexual powers are for the purpose of turning the wheel of the generations and of loving my partner in that process, my spouse. But sometimes I have a tendency to get too deep in a footnote and then forget the question. Tell me again.
do you think that the natural law?
Right. Yeah. Yes, it is. It is distinctly human. If there are other rational beings in the universe, other rational animals in the universe, we know there are other rational beings. At least in my faith tradition, angels. But they're not rational animals. They don't have bodies. If there are other rational animals, Martians, let's say, residents of Alpha Centauri 4, then they would have consciences. But an animal doesn't, because it doesn't have the kind of intellect that is capable of the recognition that something is wrong. In fact, an animal, according to Thomas Aquinas, and I think he's right about this, an animal has a mind, but it isn't a rational mind. The animal is dealing with singulars. It doesn't look at the good food and think that is good food. It thinks, okay? It doesn't form the universal categories, and to make a moral judgment you need universal categories like that.
Well, thank you, Professor Bujewski. Please make